I'm Victor Agreta from WUOT News. This is Dialogue. In 2008, the U.S. Department of Energy selected Knoxville to become a Solar America Cities partner, and it was supposed to accelerate the adoption of solar energy technologies. But did that help increase the use of solar? Are solar panels right for your home? These are some of the questions we'll ask on today's Dialogue, where we take a look at solar power in the area. And this is Dialogue from WUOT News. I'm Victor Agreta. When the Department of Energy designated Knoxville as a solar city a decade ago, the number of solar installers was smaller, the public wasn't as informed on the benefits of solar energy, and there were only two medium-sized photovoltaic systems in the city. One was a 15-kilowatt system at IAMS Nature Center. The other was an 8-kilowatt system at Mellow Mushroom near UT campus. So how far have we come since then, and what are the options for homeowners looking to reduce their bills? We're going to discuss that and more with our panel, our solar panel, if you will, and we'll take your questions later on in the program. I'm joined by Dr. Stephen Smith with the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy and Harvey Abuleta with Solar Alliance. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
So let's get started here. I'm curious, what is the significance of Knoxville being designated a solar city in 2008? I know that you worked on this, Stephen.
Right. At that time, there was still a lot of education that was necessary, and we were working with the administration, Mayor Haslam, actually, and we were wanting people to understand that solar was a viable option, that Knoxville could easily become a leader, and there were a number of policy things that Knoxville was looking at doing. They were encouraging solar, and they wanted to help with education, and the city even invested a little bit of money to help with that education. And it's clearly played off, because there's been jobs, there's been local development of solar, and it was a good start at the time. This technology is moving very, very rapidly, and current Mayor Rojero is very supportive of solar, but I think we need to continue to be thinking about innovative ways and policies to continue to grow that.
And what about a lack of financial incentives and zoning and permitting restrictions? Have those concerns gone down in that amount of time?
There still are issues, but I think that solar is much more accepted generally, and I think that we've overcome a lot of the barriers relative to what the city can do. I think now we're facing some challenges from the utilities.
Harvey, can you speak to that a little bit from the installation side? I mean, is it easier now than it was 10 years ago?
Yeah, I want to go back to, real quick, the designation of Solar City, because SAFE, Steve Smith, Aaron Gill, they did an amazing job. And that really catapulted all of us in, you know, that were installers into, you know, actually real businesses. You know, at the time, prior to the Solar City, we were doing very boutique jobs, you know, so solar on cabins up in the mountains, or, you know, on houseboats, you know, places that were remote. And it was, again, very boutique jobs. The fact that they put such a great education program around it, both technology and financial, it made it, you know, it gave it relevance to, you know, a community that didn't understand it or hadn't really heard of it before, but it gave the whole industry legitimacy. So, you know, SACE and the city, Aaron Gill, did an amazing job. So we went from these boutique jobs to a lot of commercial jobs, like a Wampler's Farm Sausage and, you know, the McFarland Pharmacies of the world, and it just really catapulted our business. As far as incentives go, I think Steve is exactly right. He's definitely got his finger on the pulse. Prices have dropped so dramatically. I mean, when we first got into this business, just a solar panel alone cost us as a construction contractor $5.35 a watt. Now we're installing, you know, megawatts for, you know, under $1.50 a watt. So the pricing has dropped so dramatically, and the you know, just the technology, as far as the construction technology, it's easier to put in, it's faster, it's cleaner. So, you know, what might have taken us, you know, 30 days to install takes us now, you know, 3 to 5 days. So it's you know, everything about it has not only has material costs dropped, our skill set has increased, and the technology, the construction technology, has dramatically improved. So I think just like any emerging technology or disruptive technology, even there's always going to be kind of deer in the headlight thing. I mean, I think utilities are struggling with how do they fit in with this change, this, distributed solar or distributed energy, period. So they are really struggling with the idea of, well, if people start producing their solar, their volume drops. And then, they still have the same brick and mortar overhead costs. So now what do they do to make up for that difference? And really, I want to say this, too. I think this is very important. Producing energy is not the problem that utilities are struggling with. It's easy for them to hang their hat on that. But really what's changing in the industry is all the efficient appliances, lighting, air conditioning. You know, you can get an air conditioner now that's SEER 22 at a very reasonable cost. So our needs as consumers, manufacturers, are really dropping dramatically. And that's where I think the spiral effect is happening. So I've got one utility. We service 8 states. One utility in Kentucky, LG&E, basically has a program that says if I want solar, I go to the utility, and you can either buy it yourself and put it in and go behind the meter and use the energy, or the utility itself will install the solar for you. We just finished a job for LG&E in Kentucky where the utility bought the solar system for the customer. It was installed, and now they, basically make payments through their utility bill. So that utility, to me, is the most progressive I've seen out there. So I think they're going to catch on, but it's a slow and difficult process because there's so many changes happening so quickly.
Now, when you say behind the meter, what does that mean?
It means that you're putting the power in and you're actually using it. So there's a lot of different installations or accounting of the power. So you can have a dual meter system, which is like in the TVA region, where you have your meter for power coming in, then you have a separate meter to account for the power that TVA is actually buying, or your local utilities buying. Then there's net metering, where what happens is it's a single meter, but it's a bidirectional meter where you whatever power you use, you go ahead and use it. Whatever power you create in excess, it actually runs your meter backwards. So you more or less get a retail credit for the power that goes back on the grid. And then, there is, essentially behind the meter where you're just taking the power and you're using it directly. Whatever you don't use actually may spill over into the utility, but you don't get any money for it. And you just have to look at your load profile to see if that makes sense. In a lot of cases, manufacturers especially, it makes a lot of sense because we're basically building in their base load during those peak hours. And so they're actually consuming well over what we're producing, but it helps them lower their cost averaging, lowering their energy cost.
Gotcha. Now,
does that make sense?
It does, yeah. And Stephen, I want to dial back just a minute because he mentioned something that kind of caught my ear. I've been doing a little bit of research on this, and I found it interesting that we are in a world where things like Energy Star, just overall energy awareness. I mean, I remember TVA ads from the 90s that encourage you to fall asleep with the TV on. You know, it's like, right, we'll make plenty of power, all that. It's interesting to me that we do have far more efficient appliances now. We have things like the Nest thermostats that can save you, electricity, save you money, all That's this right. kind of thing. Homes tend to be more efficient now, but people are using more energy because they have more devices. And also, homes are like 30% on average, 30% bigger than they used to be built, right? People want these open right. floor plans and area and that kind of thing. How does that factor into our energy footprint overall?
Well, the interesting thing is, and Harvey was correct, the overall trend since the recession has been that energy demand is flat to even declining, even with more plugged-in devices, mm-hmm. larger houses. And the reason for this is that the Department of Energy had a set of energy standards that they required at the federal level to upgrade refrigerators. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when the compressor and refrigerator used to come on, the lights used to dim in the house, mm-hmm. right? That is non-existent anymore. I mean, the refrigerators are more efficient, the heating and cooling systems. LED, light-emitting electrodes, are completely destroying the energy use on lighting, because it used to be we had an incandescent bulb that would, you touch it, it was very hot after mm-hmm. you used it. It was a better heater than it was a light source. Then we went to the Curlicue compact fluorescents, and now we're going to LED. You're going from roughly 100 watts to 15 watts to less than 5 watts. And so these trends have flattened out the demand, and the utilities are struggling with their business model because people are using less. It's not to say that there's not a way around that, and we can talk more about that, but it has impacted the industry. And that's a good thing, because that means there's less fuel being burned. It means the utilities have to build less infrastructure. And if they do the planning right and they incorporate these trends, it actually takes the pressure off of them and gives them more flexibility. Some utilities, though, still are kind of in an older mindset, and they are resisting these changes, and that's where the friction begins to come with things like solar, storage, and electric vehicles. Now, electric vehicles have the potential to actually help create more demand for the utilities. And if it's done correctly, in other words, if we get people to charge at night more than the day, it really helps the utilities, because it helps them flatten out some of the wave of how they use energy. So these are things that require innovation. They require some forward thinking, and they require embracing new ideas. And different utilities are doing that at different paces.
Well, and do you have experience with the utility he was talking about up in Kentucky?
Less with Kentucky. I think that's a great example. Mm-hmm. We do work throughout the Southeast, and we are finding a lot of variation. Mm-hmm. We're finding some utilities are leaning into the solar more. Some are leaning into electric vehicles more. But all of them are experiencing this flat to declining load growth, which is forcing them to rethink the way they do business and how they structure some things. And then TVA is completely unique, because they are a self-regulated federal monopoly that has no independent oversight, and therefore what they do internally in a very insular way affects 7 southeastern states, because they're the largest public power provider in the United States. And there's really not the kind of checks and balances that we see in the discussions we're having in other parts of the Southeast. So we can get into that more.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. So you're listening to Dialogue from WUOT News. And this is Dialogue from WUOT News. I'm Victor Agreta. Today, we're talking about solar energy for the region and for your home. I'm joined by Harvey Abuleta and Dr. Stephen Smith. And we'd also like to hear from you. So if you have any questions, you can reach us via Twitter at WUOTFM on our Facebook page. Or you can also call in 865-974-5050. We actually have our first question, and I want to go ahead and get this out of the way real quick. Harvey, I'm going to ask you this one. How much demand is there from home buyers for houses with solar panels?
that demand goes up and down. This year, I think we are on a decline for residential solar, mostly because the incentive from TVA through the utilities has dropped considerably. So in a home where, you know, when you think about it, you're using energy in the evening, not during the day. So it's important that you have either a net metering program where you can have it credited during the day at a retail level, or you're getting paid a retail amount during the dual with a dual meter. So the fact that you're using most of your energy in the evening, you know, say from, you know, 5 o'clock till 10 o'clock at night, and the solar is producing during the day, you know, your loads and usage are not paired up with each other. So our residential has dropped a lot this year. Now, as far as the manufacturers go, it's increased dramatically because, like I said, these guys are just going behind the meter. There's no incentive for them to work with the utility, so they just want to go behind the meter and just take the savings directly. So our commercial business has stayed very strong. Our residential business has gotten much, much weaker. Where we are doing residential It's basically systems that are almost, that we call them hybrid, but they're almost off-grid. They have battery storage, and batteries, by the way, have come down dramatically, and that will really help residential sales. But our most of our systems that we're doing residential have a battery, they have solar, and they also have a generator included in that. So, and they are tied to the grid. So it's really a combination of things. But our batteries, I think, sales have gone up dramatically. So I think once those prices drop a little bit more, you're going to see another surge in residential solar, because they won't be depending on the utility for net metering or an incentive program. They won't care.
Steven?
Yeah, so let me give a little more context to what Harvey is saying. TVA, to their credit, has been a leader in solar in the past. They had a really innovative program where they were providing an incentive above the retail cost of electricity. So right now, here in KUB land and across the region, we're paying about 10 cents a kilowatt hour, roughly, for electricity. And TVA used to offer people who put solar. When I put solar on my house back in 2009, they gave a nice incentive. It was almost like what was called a feed-in tariff, where they gave you an incentive above the retail rate to incentivize you. But the price of solar was more expensive there. As prices have come down, they've decreased the amount above retail that they were willing to give. We had an agreement with them, at least we thought we did, that we would, you know, keep that at retail and they wouldn't go below retail. For the first time in the history of the TVA program, they have now gone where they are paying less for solar than it costs you to get to pay them for power. But yet they're requiring us to be in this buy-all, sell-all agreement, meaning that, as Harvey talked about earlier, you have 2 meters. So that in some ways, we would argue that we're not getting the full value for the solar we're generating. And so as Harvey says, a lot of people now are saying, you know what, I don't want to give you the solar that I produce. I want to use it for myself because it's actually more valuable. And if you couple the solar panels with a battery, you can keep that power and even at night have the battery serve your load, and it ends up helping. And as Harvey says, the battery costs are dropping dramatically. What's very, I think, tricky for the utilities, and this is where we think they're making a real mistake, is the more they drive people behind the meter and less they have that direct relationship, the more it will erode their load overall. And if they had maintained a good working relationship with the solar community and with those of us who are advocating for the solar community, I think we could have managed that relationship better. TVA this year made a very fundamental, stark change where they're giving residential customers less than retail and they're giving commercial customers even less. They're down at like 7 cents, and they plan on dropping those numbers even further. And so this is where I think they've made a fundamental change, and I think a fundamental error that will likely in the future come back and really bite them.
Mm. Well, we actually have a solar developer on the phone, and they've got a comment about solar pricing. Hi, this is Victor. Oh, hold on. Yeah, go ahead.
My name is John Atkins. I know those three guys. I would like to hitchhike on the comment about with regard to TVA, and also with regard to pricing. Am I on the air now?
Should you
I
are.
Continue
yep.
Continue to talk. Okay, great. We have developed 28 schools in East Tennessee with about 1.3 megawatts of solar under the TVA program, under the one that Dr. Smith just described. It was a very good program. The schools have put up no money, they have no risk, and yet they're guaranteed almost $1 million in the next 20 years. That was a very good program, and there are about 1,500 additional schools in Tennessee that probably have an interest in that kind of thing. Now, my other comment relates to the relative cost of solar. We in the solar business have been talking about how good a thing it is for many years. But recently, I did a specific analysis of particularly the TVA program as it is now. And I compared the amount of electricity that would be generated by a 50-kilowatt a TVA-approved system versus buying the same amount of electricity without installing solar, and then also then doing the same thing behind the meter. And what I found is that I'm comfortable now making the claim that solar is such a good financial investment that anyone who can bring together the money to have the system installed in the first place is far better off having solar than not having solar.
Agreed.
It is a dramatic change, even here in Tennessee and other places where they do have net metering and so forth, would even be better. So that's my comment. Thank
Excellent.
You very much.
Thanks so much, John.
I want to
go ahead, Harvey.
Go ahead and jump on that as well. This is Harvey. And you know, right now, the levelized cost of energy or the cost over the life of the system, we're putting in systems where the cost is less than 2.5 cents per kilowatt hour over the life of the system. And the way we do that is we estimate, and there's a lot of programs out there and software that help you really give you a great crystal ball as to how the system's going to perform. We project the performance over 20 to 25 years, depending on the warranty, and then we divide it by the cost that to install, and then in some cases we'll put the value of money today or in future value. But anyway, by the time we do all that and figure in taxes and everything else, we're on a larger system, a commercial system, we're definitely under 2.5 cents per kilowatt hour. Well, even if you were an industrial served customer and you were paying 4 cents, solar's still producing energy less than the utility can sell it to you for. So John is exactly right on that.
Stephen?
And so because of this trend, and because TVA is aware of this trend, these prices getting so low, what they have done, which is a bit devious in my opinion, is they have decided that they want to shift more of the cost onto what's called a non-bypassable fixed charge, where they actually, instead of letting you pay as you go, so to speak, the way most people recognize they're paying for power, where it's based on the amount you use, they want you to pay an increasing amount in a monthly fixed charge regardless of how much power you use. And KUB, Knoxville Utility Board, has been particularly egregious about that because for the residential customer, when I looked at my bill in 2010, I was paying a monthly customer charge. And I encourage people who are listening to go back, look at their bill. It's clearly called out in there, of $6.09. Between 2009 and 2018, that has gone up to $17.50. And KUB has already approved another $1.50 that will kick in October of this year and another $1.50 that's going to kick. So it's going to be over $20. So you're going to be paying $20 before you even turn on the first light switch in your house. Some of the TVA local power companies across the 7-state region have gotten now close to $30. And many of them don't even make that visible on the monthly bill, so citizens don't even see this. And then at a May board meeting down in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, just a few weeks ago, TVA announced for the first time in their history that they're going to put what they call a quote-unquote grid access fee, which would then drive up on the wholesale level more fixed charges. And then they claim, oh, we don't know how the local power companies are going to respond to that. Well, I can bet you money that you're going to see increasing pressure to raise the fixed charges. And why this is insidious is, one, people lose the ability to control the amount. So if you invest in energy efficiency and everything, you're getting less of a rate of return on that because you're still having to pay that fixed charge regardless of how much you use. It particularly hurts if you invest in solar. And this is an intentional program that TVA is doing to try to undercut the solar market in raising these fixed charges. TVA literally claims that they want to raise to where as much as 70% of your bill is in fixed charges. And we think that that is unprecedented. It's being done nowhere else in the United States. We fought this very hard, but because, again, TVA is unregulated, there was no independent arbitrator of this. So once the executives at TVA convinced the TVA board they're self-regulated, they basically checked off on it, and there you go. So this trend is happening both at residential and it's happening even more intensely at a commercial level. And I think people who are listening to this need to understand and pay attention, because we need to push back against this. Otherwise, you're going to lose more and more of your ability to control your local bill, your monthly bill.
Mm-hmm. We've got another question on the phone from Terry in Brewstertown. Hey, Terry, you're on Dialogue.
Thank you. Since the coal and oil industry has turned about face and are now crying for because they can't compete and they're wanting regulations cut so that they can pollute more and get other forms of subsidies, do you think we'll start finally getting more honest information and evaluations in comparisons?
That's a good question. Thanks.
Well, it is a good question. I'll take a quick stab, and Harvey may want to chime into this. What we're seeing right now is that coal in particular has been just devastated by natural gas prices. Natural gas prices are the lowest they've historically been, and they're projected to stay very low. And it's really changed the way. And so TVA has shifted away from coal a lot more to natural gas. But natural gas is still a fossil fuel. It still has emissions. It still has pollution, although it is technically in some ways cleaner than coal. There's been a lot of challenges with the nuclear power industry in getting nuclear power plants. I mean, TVA did get Watts Bar 2 up, but it took them 40 plus years or something. You know, it's a crazy long project, cost billions of dollars. And so now the coal industry and the nuclear power industry has gone to the Trump administration and said, in competitive places where they're having to compete on a level playing field with other technologies, they can't compete anymore. Mm-hmm. And they're asking for the Trump administration to intervene to protect these, and then you're seeing a lot of rolling back of protective regulations around air and water and everything in the coal industry. So this is going to be a real interesting period of time to see how that plays out. All the time, while the costs are going up for coal and nuclear power, solar prices and storage prices are coming down, and that is going to put tension on where we ultimately end up. So we're pretty bullish on what renewables can do. We think they should continue to grow unless the utilities put these regressive policies in place to artificially hold it back. Yeah. And that's what really worries us.
Just a reminder, this is Dialogue for WUOT News. We're talking about solar energy, and if we'd like to hear from you. My guests are Harvey Abuleta and Dr. Stephen Smith. And if you want to get in touch with us, you can do that on Twitter. We've got a few more Twitter questions we'll get to in just a minute. Also on our Facebook page, and you can call in at 865-974-5050. And actually, Harvey, this is a question from Twitter that came in. Can you go over the basics of getting panels installed? I mean, do they always go on the roof? I'm assuming they can't go in the basement, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I let me answer that question in a second, because I want to just jump on with something Steve said, and I'm sorry for keep going back.
That's fine.
But, you know, the fixed cost on your utility bill, I want you to think about this. If you went to a gas station and I spent money on like a Prius, you know, a hybrid where, you know, I've only got a 10-gallon tank, and I went to the gas station and first, before I even could turn on the pump, I had to pay $10 as a cost for the right to fill up my pump, my gas, and then I only have a 10-gallon tank. Well, that $10 over my 10 gallons, you know, is $1 a gallon, versus I've got a commercial pickup truck, and it maybe have a 50-gallon tank on it and two tanks, and I pay $10, that same $10 to fill that up, but now I take that $10 and put it over, you know, 50 gallons, now it's, you know, 50 cents a gallon. And so it the way those charges work, it almost penalizes you for trying to cut costs or, you know, in a lot of people's mind, do the right thing of decreasing fossil fuels. So, you know, if you just look at your vehicle that we fill up every day and you apply that same analogy, you would think that was ludicrous. You would never go to that gas station to get gas ever in your life. There would be no reason why you would do that, but you have choices, competitive choices, whereas with your electricity, you do not have competitive choices. So I just wanted to kind of put that in perspective as to how you pay that bill. And then one other comment, too, about coal versus natural gas. So many of these plants, that coal plants, have been converted over to natural gas. It's just so much more efficient. I'm no economist at all, so, you know, take it with a grain of salt, but I don't ever see the light of day for coal ever again. And it's not because of solar. It's not because of nuclear.
It's because natural gas just crushed them. And, you know, the utilities put a lot of money into converting these plants over to natural gas and putting in these gas turbines. I just don't even see that coming back. That would be like a double cost to bring something back that's inefficient. And Steve would probably know a lot more about that than I would.
Yeah, it does seem like we're... Go ahead. Hmm?
Yeah. I think the coal industry is...
We're past the point of
trouble. Yeah, I think we're not going to see that return. I mean, there's efforts to try to do it, but I think they're actually really kind of misleading some people in the mining industry that there's some sort of renaissance coming. And, mm-hmm. and I've been very critical of the folks that are trying to give false hope, because I just think it's not productive, because it's just like the whaling industry. At some point, you went from whale oil to electric light bulbs, right? The buggy whip industry, you went from buggy whips to cars. At some point, technology moves on, and if you give people false hope that it's going to be, you actually prolong their economic hardship instead of work with them on an economic transition.
Mm-hmm. Right. As far as getting solar on your home, with Google Earth and all the technology, and especially the software, the predictive software about how it'll perform, it's a pretty easy process to go through. And I don't want to be pitchy, so I'll tell you our process, but I'm sure most installers is the exact same thing. Essentially, you send us an address. We plug that address in on Google Earth. We look at your rooftop, and we look at, you know, trees and any kind of obstructions around there. We can put solar on your roof. We can build, pergolas and put solar on that. We can put solar on the ground and do ground mounts. We can do pole mounts. So there's a variety of ways that we can install the solar. Once we look at your roof and we find probably the best installation, or what we feel is the best, you know, is your house orientated right? Do you have the right slope? Do you have, you know, how much shade issues do you have? What time of day? Then we can take that rooftop. We can measure it, get a ballpark of how much solar we can put on it. And we can put that into another software. A very common free one is called PV Watts. You can put in your address, and so it'll get 10 years worth of weather data in that zip code area. So it becomes very accurate as far as predicting, you know, the amount of solar radiance that you have available to produce energy. And then we can get very specific about a solar panel that we're using, an inverter, wire sizing, and any kind of losses. Then we can turn around and predict how much power we can produce. We can give you a basic estimate about the cost, and then so you can see what your cost per kilowatt is going to be. You can see, you know, over the life of the system, you know, the bottom line is, you know, you want it to cash flow. So if I'm paying $100 for my utility bill, you know, when I put solar in on my home, you know, I'm hoping that instead of it being $100, it's, you know, $95 or $80. So I'm actually preserving my cash flow over time, and eventually getting that payback. From there, if you say those numbers look good, we come out, we do a technical site visit. A person actually physically gets up on your roof if it's a roof mount, or we look at the area for the ground mount. And then we do a final engineering design. We submit it for permitting. And then depending on, you know, whether you're doing batteries or whatever, you know, we may apply for the utility through the GPP program, through your local utility, and then we permit it, and in different areas it requires different permits, and then we order materials, and the construction usually on a residential day job is maybe 3 days, 5 days tops, depending on, you know, I mean, obviously weather can impact that. So does that kind of...
Yeah, that's a good overview. Yep, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Dialogue from WUOT News. We'll be back in a moment to take more of your questions. And this is Dialogue from WUOT News. I'm Victor Agreta. We are talking about solar energy, both around the region and, of course, for your home. And I'm joined by Dr. Stephen Smith and Harvey Abuleta. We'd like to hear from you. If you have any questions, you can reach us via Twitter at WUOTFM on our Facebook page, or you can call in 865-974-5050. We do have someone on the phone I'm going to get to in just a second, but I think their question is similar to sort of what I grew up with this idea of energy independence. I actually grew up in a passive solar home. We had a huge wall that had big black, you know, panels, and we had these salt trays in the bottom that would collect
thumb
the
wall,
heat. Exactly,
wall, yeah.
And then, you know, that's where our heat came from. So Let me get to our caller here from Mike, because he's got a question about energy independence, which is something that I remember as a kid. Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing well, sir. Thank you.
What was your question?
My question is, I'm getting ready to build a house for a family of two kids and a wife, and is there any way that I can go energy independent, or do I actually have to be set up with KUB or some other utility company providing to my house?
To be completely off the grid, right?
Correct.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Is that legal? I mean, is that...
Good question.
It is absolutely legal. You can be off the grid if you want to. And again, choosing that, you have many, many more options today than you did, say, 20, 30 years ago, because the battery technology is advanced. The inverter technology, which converts the direct current that comes off the panels to alternating current, which we lose in our homes. Some people who used to be off the grid used to have to come up with completely different appliances to do direct current. That has all changed. It is so much easier to do it. And there's ways to do really creative things that way that you can save money. And, you know, again, as you were talking about with passive solar, I've got solar photovoltaics for the electricity, but I also have solar hot water, which makes a huge amount of sense, because the sun's beating down on your roof and there's no reason for you to take, you know, water that comes in from your water line at roughly 60 degrees from underground and take it up to 120 when the sun can do that for you, save you all kinds of money. The other thing we have in our house is what are called solar tubes, which actually let natural daylight into the house and direct it into various rooms. So we don't have to, you know, if you're turning on your lights during the day because your house is dark and yet the sun is out there. I'm old enough, 56 years old. The one thing that has been consistent in my life every single day is that the sun comes up in the east and it sets in the west. And I literally, and I've said this, and I've offended some people by saying this, but I think it is for future generations, I think it is criminal that when the sun is out, that we are burning fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. Because in a single hour, in a single day, on the total face of the earth, we get more energy from the sun than we do use and all of humanity uses across the earth. It is a phenomenal resource, whether it is turning in electricity, whether it's heating hot water, whether it's passive solar like you're talking about, whether it's natural lighting. A lot of stores, schools, everybody's realizing natural daylight, it makes you feel better, it's healthier for you, and all these other kind of things. And we just can be smarter in our design. So I think when you're building a home, yes, you can do all these different technologies and combine them together, and you can make yourself. My home, until I started driving an electric vehicle, was virtually net zero, meaning that I was generating as much power mm-hmm. as I was using. Now, when I started driving an electric car, I've taken that up a little bit. But it's all there for the taking if we're just smart about it.
Mike, good luck to you on that. Thanks.
I've thought the same thing as you did as well. When I was young, I'm like, hold on, when I first saw solar panels, like, why are we not harnessing them?
Yeah.
Mike, thanks for your call.
All right.
Yeah, and I think, you know, today it's easier than it ever has been, mostly because efficient appliances, it's kind of like going on a diet or knowing what your food is. I mean, it's so easy today with the proper labeling and everything to know exactly what you're eating, how many calories, you know, and you can track it on your, you know, smartphone. There really isn't a reason that you don't strive for net zero in homes today. The technology for, you know, spray foam, metal roofs, radiant barrier, efficient appliances, it's all pointing to a big win for you and the ability to do it. Now, again, with the price of batteries coming down, again, that's going to get easier and financially more easier. And then, of course, as a safety net, you know, I would always recommend having a natural gas generator included in that mix. And that is your safety net if you have, you know, from December to, you know, you get a week of cloudy days and rain and whatever, and you can fall back to that generator to pull you out of it. Now, again, with the dual fuel heating systems and HVAC, it's very simple for you to move that direction. So,
Steven?
More, especially with a new build.
Yeah.
Retrofit, obviously, is always much more difficult.
Yeah.
But new builds, you know, California is basically saying in their new code that it's criminal to exactly what Steve said. It's criminal to use energy when there's the sun out. And so their code is requiring new build to have solar included in that.
So let me pick up on a different thread that I think is important for people to understand. Lots of people have criticized solar power and some of these energy efficiency as being, you know, for the wealthy and this, that, and the other. Southern Alliance for Clean Energy has done a lot of analysis on sort of what's going on across the Tennessee Valley and across the Southeast about what are called energy burdens, meaning TVA brags a lot about having, quote unquote, low rates, but nobody pays a rate. They actually pay a bill. And the bill is the rate you pay times the amount of energy you consume. And that, for a number of low-income citizens and a number of African-American citizens, say in Memphis, we've determined through our analysis and other organizations that Memphis has the highest energy burden of any city in the United States, meaning that a customer is paying a higher percentage of their revenue, a low-income customer in the inner city area. So these energy efficiency investments have got to be pushed into the low-income community aggressively. KUB has done some work. TVA was actually fined by the EPA over some air violations, and they then invested what's called a supplemental environmental project to actually support some low-income, and there was a extreme energy makeover. We did some good things. We're working very closely now with the NAACP and others to be looking at how do we look at energy efficiency and how do we look at solar to make sure that it is reaching all segments of society and isn't just sort of a wealthy boutique type of thing. And the reality is the best way to lower those energy burdens is to get these energy efficiency investments in so that people aren't having to pay as much and it becomes a pathway out of poverty. And a lot of people have looked at how do you then train people in the inner city to actually go and do these energy efficiency retrofits in people's homes, maybe get involved with doing some community solar projects and other things like that, so that these communities can take advantage of the energy independence and lift themselves out of the energy burdens, both with not having to pay as much each month, but then also with being able to actually be employed. And this is a very innovative area, and we would like to see our utilities embracing it instead of resisting it, because there are the least of those amongst us that are struggling. And putting more fixed charges actually hurts low-income customers more than it does you and I, because it particularly hurts low users. And that's some of the challenges we're up against. So there's an equity, an energy equity issue that's alive here that we've got to pay attention to. And we think that the utilities are so worried about their own kind of survival that they're not seeing the larger benefits to society of really letting these technologies run more free and adjusting their business model instead of trying to extract more from the citizens.
Not to mention, it seems like the point of innovation is to, of course, be ahead of the curve. Right, you're not following. You're not sucking wind. You're trying to get ahead of all of this.
Well, and there's the famous Wayne Gretzky thing. The reason he's good was he learned where he wasn't going, where the puck was now is where the puck was going. And this is what we keep trying to get the utilities to focus on. You're playing for the longer game here, and if you're not careful, these disruptive technologies are going to just really eat your lunch. And you need to be, because as you start looking at, people like you're seeing, if you go into Home Depot and you're seeing the Internet of Things, all these Nest thermostats, all these things that now are communicating with your smart device, your cell phone, where you can do all kinds of things to monitor your home, the millennials are eating that stuff up. Mm-hmm. And they are used to on-demand responsive stuff over their phone, and being able to smartly control their house remotely and being able to see their power being generated and being able to have access to this stuff is going to be the expectation they have.
Absolutely. We do have a good question from Twitter. Gil has a question of what is the top challenge for solar energy in the state, and what can people do to help promote solar in the state?
Well, I think the top challenge right now is making sure that the utilities, so TVA is the wholesaler, and then there's 154 local power companies that, like KUB and National Electric Service and others, we've got to make sure that they don't continue on this sort of anti-solar development trend that they're in now. We did a solar report, Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, and we actually gave TVA a Sun Blocker Award for the first time ever, because these policies of raising fixed charges. Right now, we're about 83% behind where we were last year on solar insulations because of this structural change where they went below the retail rate for the small systems. TVA has not even executed a single contract this year with their local power companies on what are called community solar. And then TVA has a 200 megawatt, what's called a request for proposal out to do big systems that they've had out now for over a year, and they haven't executed on any of that. It has just come to almost an absolute standstill. So one of the biggest policy challenges is getting utilities to where they are engaging constructively with the solar industry and with citizens who want to do it, and they're not instituting rate change policy. They're not dragging their feet on executing on contracts. That's the biggest challenge. The other thing, though, is working with local cities and everything to basically set – lots of cities now are setting their own goals, and you're seeing cities across the country begin to set policies of trying to be much more renewable-based. And we think that the cities in Tennessee need to start looking at that, and we'd love to see the current mayor and the future mayors begin to look more at setting aggressive goals, because that's real leadership and innovation, and it prods the utilities to – get out of this regressive way of looking at this and become more of a leader.
Harvey, what do you see from your side of the table?
Yeah, this is my soapbox. I can jump on this one. You know, the thing is with utilities, one utility, Lenoir City, LCUB, Shannon Littleton said, you know, my job is, yes, to provide reliable power, but more importantly, my job is to provide economic development for my community. And the utility is the heart and soul of economic development, especially in manufacturing and industry. And so, you know, not only it's the utilities, TVA. I mean, if you look in site locations, so these major companies, whether it be, you know, GM or Google or Microsoft, always in the top 10, they're going to be looking for what is the utility like there? What is the cost of my power? You've got to give them an on-ramp, especially the newer, you know, like the Googles, the Amazons, and Microsoft. You've got to give them an on-ramp for renewable energy. And it goes beyond renewable energy. You have to give them an on-ramp as to zero waste, period. So, you know, eliminating landfills and providing renewable energy and providing just responsible utilities, that is a big deal in economic development. And so we have to look at this as not a thing of and I'm not making this light of this. I mean, it's not just an environmental issue; it is an economic issue, and we have to embrace that. So the education has to go to the point of how are we going to attract businesses here? You know, if we want people to move to Tennessee, we have to have better education. We have to have lower cost utilities. We have to have smarter labor. I mean, it's just that whole combination. It's not just one thing. So it's very important, I think, that we get control of our utility costs and look at it in the sense like Shannon Littleton is they are really the backbone for economic development, and they have that responsibility to bring that to the table for the entire community. And that's got nothing to do with solar. That's just got to do with making sense for our state. We want to increase that tax base, right? So it's that's a big part of it. And I've looked at a million site assessment areas, you know, for these businesses trying to locate. I've never seen one that not in the top 10 that the utility did not show up in that top 10 questions.
Wow.
So and I can go on for this for hours.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this month's dialogue. I want to thank you both for joining me, Harvey Abuleta and Dr. Stephen Smith with the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. Thank you to all of our guests and all of our listeners and everyone who contributed questions. This show is a production of 91.9 FM WUOT. I want to thank our engineer, Greg Hill. I'm Victor Agreta. This is Dialogue.